This morning, I chose the title Love and Caesar because I want to talk, begin with, about Christian love as it relates to politics or government, in order that you can have my view on that. And then from that, I'd be glad to get into whatever is of interest to you. I'd like to take one session on education legislation because that's where I spend most of my time. I would be glad to talk about the whole Watergate thing sometime if you want to do that, or the political process, which way we're going there, which seems to me, or most anything in the whole line of politics or government that you'd be interested in. And but first, I'd like to see if I can put in perspective how I see the practice of Christian love in politics. I have a colleague who struggles with this all the time, and we get together and pray together, but we also argue a great deal. And it's his view that you ought to be able to pray to God and find out an answer from him on what you ought to do. In fact, when a bill comes up, you ought to pray to God, know what God's will is, and vote on that bill accordingly. And I keep telling him that there is no such thing, that there isn't a Christian law, and it doesn't make any difference on which side of the political aisle you are on, because Christ's love has really nothing to do with that. Christ's love has something to do with relationship with people, our relationship with God, our relationship with our fellow man, and that it's as possible to pursue one course in a piece of legislation as another and still be as Christian. Now, there are moral questions that become involved in politics as well. And I, you know, when you put on the new man, I imagine you live a more moral life as well. But I've noted that the people who are professing Christians don't seem to live a more moral life than some of the non-Christians that I've had the good fortune of knowing. People who live a very strict moral life and have attitudes and morality and politics too, or ethics and politics, that are strong as any Christian that I've ever known. And so I've come to the conclusion that there are only two things that are possible through Christ that can't be found someplace else. And the one is love, as Christ lived in his life, the most difficult of all, the agape love, and that we have the difficulty of understanding because we don't have three words for it as the Greeks did. And the second one is justice. Now, I've found amongst my colleagues who have done as I did when I first went to Congress, responded to the invitation of a colleague to come down to a prayer breakfast group on Thursday morning. And a number of them, when they're new in Congress, are kind of enthusiastic about that. And I've talked to people who are on the most extreme liberal side and the most extreme conservative side. And after they've gone to the prayer breakfast for a while and learned to know their colleagues, one day, and this has happened on both sides, where I'd be sitting by the person, and that individual that they had begun to like, perhaps love in that filial way, got up and made a speech on the floor that's just contrary to their political philosophy. And right then, they rebelled. I said, that's the kind of a guy that's going to have prayer breakfast. I'm not going to go anymore. And I've had colleagues that have refused for years to go because of that, until they finally got an understanding of Christ and his love and what it really meant. And as I said, this has happened on both sides. A very liberal and a very conservative person has responded in that way. And Christ showed the most difficult of all tasks of loving is to love your enemies. And when you're engaged in a debate on a piece of legislation and differ from that person, And then he's your enemy. What I've found amongst Christians so often, then, is they feel if they love strongly enough and love another person enough, and then they'll start thinking alike politically. In fact, there's a magazine that comes across my desk, which is entitled Christian Economics. And it offends me every time I see that title, because I don't think Christianity has anything to do with economics at all. But I find this so much with my colleagues and with the people in the church I grew up in Nerstrand, Minnesota, too, because I still remember a lady who was my Sunday school teacher twice in my childhood, who met me at the door when I filed for the state senate, and she knew I was going into politics then, and on Sunday morning said to me, "Albert, I thought you were going to grow up to be such a fine young man." So, and also recall in my own mind when I was a child when the first Democrat family joined our church, and in a rural church not many people join your church anyway, so it's kind of an occasion that people leave but not many people join. And this was hard for me to understand, how you could be Democrat and Christian at the same time. They could fit at all. I find my Southern colleagues the same way. I also recall an instance when civil rights legislation was before the Congress. In fact, all of the important civil rights legislation in recent years has been passed while I've been a member of Congress. And I think there's both a political and a moral question, definitely, in civil rights. And I felt very strongly in favor of such legislation and stood in our Republican caucus when the open housing legislation was going to be up for a vote that afternoon, and made a plea to my colleagues about how important this was, that a person be able to buy a home where he wanted to, or that a person be prevented from denying another person from buying a home where he wanted to. And I ended up saying, as if I refused to sell my home to a person because of the color of his skin, I thought it was unpatriotic, un-American, and un-Christian. And, you know, you get a little worked up at times when you're pleading for legislation. And a colleague of mine who I associated with then for about 3 years in the prayer breakfast came up to me with both anger and sadness in his voice and said, "Al, do you mean to say that you don't think I'm a Christian?" Because he was going to vote against it. And I learned from that gentleman who voted against it, because on constitutional grounds, he thought it was wrong. And he just happened to put stronger feelings in property rights than in human rights, I felt. That was his judgment. Then I got to thinking, when I learned more about him, how did the Lord look at the two of us? This gentleman, prior to that, had raised the money for a townhouse in his southern city for integrated housing. And the first family to join or to buy a home was a black, and at that time was about 55% black and about 45% white. And he was, at that moment, in the midst of raising money, because that was a time when it was a little difficult to borrow money as it is right now, for another townhouse complex of integrated housing in this southern city. And I thought to myself, you know, I don't know how God looks at this, but if I was God and looked at that northern Republican who voted for the civil rights legislation, who probably get defeated in his district if he didn't, because the people kind of feel that way about in Minnesota between blacks and whites, especially in southeastern Minnesota, we don't have any blacks. There's more feeling about Indians in Minnesota than blacks, on the one hand. And this person who voted against the legislation but had actually given an opportunity to people to live in an integrated situation, that I'd certainly give him higher points than me. And I came to the conclusion again that there probably was not even a Christian position on open housing legislation, because that man, as far as I could see, is still not a Christian. as anybody that I've met. And so, to me, Christ's love expressed in government and in politics is really to love your neighbor and want the best, which means to want the best for that person, that person who disagrees with you, and it is as possible, you know, to have different philosophies of government. I mean, you look to the philosophies of government that we think are foreign to our own, but we're coming more and more that way, and that is the socialist. So that all the means of production is controlled by the government. A person can be a strong believer in Christ and follower of Christ with that philosophy. It is to be a strong capitalist. And I think this is what many people in the Congress are learning about themselves. Let me give you an example of the way I think it can work at its best. We fought for years on coal mine safety legislation. Coal mine safety legislation was just extremely controversial. It was fought in the House and the Senate and would lose out in conference, and finally it was passed when President Johnson was elected in 1964 with a landslide, and he, as different from Nixon and his landslide, brought a huge majority in the Democratic Party into the Congress, and so they were able to pass that legislation. And after that was passed, then it was necessary to work on metallic and non-metallic mine safety legislation, which prior to that time had not even been raised through the committee because of the controversy of coal mine safety legislation. And all of this means, you know, the livelihood of small mine owners who would be shut down if you have to put in the safety precautions. You know, you get the question of whether the life of a person is more important than the jobs of other people who be thrown out of work, and all those things. And by a quirk of circumstances, the chairman of the subcommittee that was working on the legislation, who is a Northern Democrat, liberal, Roman Catholic, and I say this because he's completely different than myself and all of those things that he's brought up with in his political philosophy and the whole works, I noticed he had a deep and abiding faith. You can't judge him on whether he goes to Thursday morning prayer breakfast because, you know, it wasn't conducive for him to do. He had a large family, and two of his children had some difficulty, and he needed to be there to take them to school. So you can't judge him on any of those things. But the occasion came to where we could talk about Christ, and we were going to move into that markup of that legislation. And because of a visiting dignitary, we had a prayer breakfast for him from another country, and I invited my colleague to go to it. And going back again, we got to talking about our spiritual faith. And when we reached his office, we decided that we would pray together. And a different spirit prevailed that committee meeting than normally is in a committee meeting. And as a result of that, my Republican philosophy, which is more states' rights, and his philosophy of the federal government having would preempt anything that the state would do, we blended together in setting a national standard that all states would have to meet, but any state that wanted to have their own standards, as long as they met that standard, could also administer the law themselves, and therefore we compromised our difference. It was interesting to note that that legislation went through the Congress without a dissenting vote. And I noted that somewhere or other the word must have gotten out, I don't know, but the Wall Street Journal carried a little small squib about it, and they said this legislation was put together with prayer. Mm-hmm. Now that doesn't mean, I hasten to add, that if you pray together with somebody who differs in yourself, you're always going to come out with good legislation. I just think that the Lord showed my colleague and I, through that instance, what is possible when you love each other. Because that same colleague and I, at times, have really fiercely fought each other on legislation. But because of that, we have a bond between each other. And I'd like to also share with you then how that bond can express itself. He introduced legislation on agricultural labor, which was supported by Cesar Chavez, or really came from Cesar Chavez. And I introduced legislation which would put agricultural labor into an agricultural labor relations board control the way industrial labor now is with the National Labor Relations Board. And I testified in my bill, and in the process of testifying, naturally, since he had introduced his bill beforehand, I spoke in opposition to his legislation, why his legislation was not acceptable. As I had read his legislation, I had made a mistake and had interpreted it wrong and made what you could say is an incorrect accusation about it. Now, I know this fellow, who is a very sharp attorney, and one of the things I thought he did too much was to take partisan delight of really tearing a person apart. In fact, he'd even rip apart people in his own party who he disagreed with. Very capable of that, you know, leaving them in shreds. And when I finished my testimony, he went back and pointed out the mistakes that I had made about his legislation. He did this in the kindest, most loving way that a person could do. And I realized then that it was because we both shared the love of Christ that he would relate that in that way to me. Now, I fully expected him to really go down my throat for what I had said. And I point that out to indicate that it is possible then with these differing views for people to live in that kind of love and with each other. One time, a visiting minister out in Nerstrand explained it the best way that I ever have, and that's Professor Rasmussen at St. Olaf. Now, I told our St. Olaf friends over here. And he said he knew a friend in a church that he had once served who loved automobile engines. And nothing he liked better than to work with automobile engines when he was a kid. You know, you come across all kinds of young men like that. And he became a garage man. I mean, I thought it was sort of like the guy who liked ice cream, running an ice cream parlor. But he went down to visit his friend one day, and he had just finished tuning an engine. And Pastor Rasmussen came in there, and he said, "Shh, listen, doesn't that sound peaceful?" And he had completed that tuning job, and because it was in tune, that engine could develop to its greatest horsepower. But he said if you could look inside that engine, you'd find one piston going up, another one going down, one part between the crankshaft going around, valves going up and down, gears going around, everything going in different directions. But he had it in tune. In fact, if it had all gone in the same direction, it would have blown the head off the engine. And that's what Christ's love in people's lives do. You all go in different directions according to your beliefs and what your environment has done and what you think ought to be done. But if you love each other, and then that's really the bond that keeps human beings in tune with each other. A colleague of mine talked at the prayer breakfast one morning, and this colleague happens to be from California, and before he was in Congress and was defeated, and when he was out, he was an organizer for the John Birch Society. And he was asked the question after he gave his comment of how, every weekend he flies back to California to teach his Sunday school class, and then flies back in the Red Eye Special to Washington again. I mean, that devoted. Now, if you people are like me. I mean, you probably have some reaction about a person who's a John Bircher. He was asked how then he felt he could, that the Lord was directing him, and what he thought of those people who are liberal Democrats. And he related a story that I think is really tremendous, that a black colleague from California defeated a real good friend of ours who had 100% ADA record, Americans for Democratic Action, about the most liberal accounting group for how people vote there is. He had 100% record. And this black from Berkeley defeated him because he was too conservative. And the John Bircher and the black, who hadn't met each other before but were newly elected to Congress at the same time, just happened to run across each other on the floor. And the black said to him, you know, I'd like to talk with you, you know, what motivates you? And they got together in my black colleague's office. My colleague finally asked him, he says, what's your relationship, your spiritual relationship? Do you believe in Jesus Christ? And the reaction was yes. And they got to talking about their religious faith. And the bond of Christ's love between those two individuals now enables them to respect each other, although here you find probably either the most conservative or the second most conservative person in the House, and the person who must be the most liberal or the second most liberal person in the House, and they can share that bond of fellowship through Christ's love. And I tell you that because I hope we can talk a great deal here about it. I just so concerned that Christians so often think that if you love Christ and then you'll think alike on those political matters as well as your relationship to Christ, that just isn't possible. And that you pray for a person and that he'll change his views. I recall when even in the church when we had a big battle between our two little churches in the same parish out there in Nerstrand, and we ended up dividing into two. And we finally had to take our differences to President Osgard. And one of the men who was at odds with the pastor got up and said, Pastor, I've prayed for you for a whole month, and you still haven't changed. I think that's the tendency sometimes as Christians, is that we pray for that person enough and then he'll change and start voting like we do. But I think that as one tries to develop, say in the legislative body, the policies for his country or for a state, for he's a county commissioner, for his county or city council, for his city, that he ought to work his heart for what he believes the direction that we ought to go. And that's his responsibility. Just like it's the responsibility of the piston to go up when it was fired, and that's the direction it has to go, while the other one is coming down. And yet we can be in tune with each other through Christ's love in that way. And that's really the message that Christ brings right now. The Spirit dwells in a person. I think it's possible for people to be at harmony with each other. It means that we'll never be perfect, and so at times we'll kick ourselves all over the lot because we forgot about that. And this is something I can't understand, because with myself, because I know that when you really get in trouble and you surrender yourself to the Lord, a great peace comes over you, and it's the most wonderful thing. But how come you keep fighting it all the time and try and work it out yourself, and then to have that happen again? And I imagine most people's lives are operated that way, so you can act in a very unchristian way at times and then feel sorry for it. But I think from that spirit it is possible for us, which legislation is the art of compromise, to reach policies that are the best for the country, and then So I just wanted to throw this out and see if any of you wanted to have any comments about that before we get into any of the specifics of legislation.
Yeah. The main idea that you have over and over stated, it seemed to be a kind of open and free communication and rooted in the Christian belief and love that we passed up on the board. Our major problems today seem to be the result of totally ignoring that. Irrational secrecy, under the table action, behind the back action, both in politics and business. And it seems to be the openness and the freedom that would seem to be the contrast here. Can you speak a little bit to hope or evidence of change in this irrational aura of secrecy that surrounds so much of our actions?
Well, Dale, I think you have to be traveling, usually, in what may be a period of a contrasting course. And I think we have difficulty in our logic to do that. I've always enjoyed reading about the concept of, as our roots are in Greek logic, that we can only travel one course and think and not be able to travel a contrasting one at the same time. And they say a Hebrew, and they have to, and if you really understand the scriptures, you have to think of it as a Hebrew that has traveled two contrasting courses at the same time. I think there are periods where secrecy is necessary. And Dr. Judd used the example that at least when two people are learning to know each other, where you end up in a marriage vow or that compact, that has to be done in secret. You can't very well do that out in public. And so there are times when you talk in secret with a person. But I think now we have been operating too much in secret. There's been too much stamped confidential and secret in the executive branch, and the Congress was doing too much behind closed doors. And so the Congress is now in the process of change. Our Education Labor Committee was the first committee to do that, to adopt rules that all of executive sessions be open to the public. And this has now become the way of the Congress, except that the committee can, by a majority vote, close its meetings to the public. And a number of the committees that have not had the experience of open meetings have actually then, by majority vote, closed their meetings. And so the House, this last year, changed its rule that if you're going to have a closed markup, you have to vote by majority vote to have it closed each time you do it, so that you don't do it for the whole session of the Congress. And at first it was difficult for members to do. It was difficult for the press. I remember some of the press coming up to me afterwards and said, why didn't you close this meeting? It gets much easier when you handed out press releases when we got to figure out what all this is going on. He said, how come the committee is such a wild operation? Now when it's out in public, and I said, well, you should have seen it when it was private. and the fighting that was going on there. So I think that there is a pressure on Congress to be more open, and undoubtedly on the executive as well. Common cause is a pressure that's being put on in an organized way, and Ralph Nader also, I think, are probably the two forces in the organized way putting pressure on. But I don't think there's an either or. There are times I find in the committee where it's necessary for members to sit down together with each other in private and work out their differences. For example, when the education legislation was up, I wanted to develop it so that there would be more parent involvement in Title I programs. Shirley Chisholm of New York had the same idea. It looked like we were going to be at odds with each other, and I recognize that there are more Democratic votes than Republican votes, so it's best to get a hold of Shirley Chisholm and sit down and talk over our differences. And so we sat together in private then and talked over our differences and resolved them so that we came to the committee unified in the kind of parent involvement. And there, in the open, we offered the amendment and was adopted by our colleagues. It was necessary at all times that every conversation between individuals was known to anyone else in the country or of our colleagues. I just don't think it would have worked, because it was necessary for a period there for Shirley Chisholm and I to talk in private with each other and have in confidence and keep in confidence what we said to each other. Because if I would go back and report everything that she said, it would break down a confidence that we'd never be able to build up again. So we have to travel with two tracks at the same time. Keep in confidence what we said to each other, because if I would go back and report everything that she said, it would break down a confidence that we'd never be able to build up again. So we have to travel with two tracks at the same time.
I was wondering if you'd say a little bit more about the concept of justice that you mentioned. When you talked at Hale's commencement about the expression of love and government coming out through the concept of justice, I'd like if you could enlarge on that a little bit and explain.
Well, for a long time I had a struggle with what the difference between love and justice was, and for a while I thought perhaps they were the same. And now I'm convinced that love expresses itself through justice in institutions. And I believe that governments or institutions or organizations are incapable of love. That it's individuals that love God, love another person or a group of people. But if you ask institutions to love, it's just something that they are incapable of doing. And through institutions, then, love expresses itself through justice. And so as an individual, you don't keep track of the wrongs of another person. But you must do that in justice and make sure everybody's then receives what is rightfully his. And I guess it would be like, as a Christian, we're taught to turn the other cheek. But if you're wrong, but if you see somebody else being wrong, you then try and protect them from that wrong, and that to make sure that justice prevails for that person. You don't then go and turn their other cheek for them, because you know that's what you're supposed to do, and that only comes to them as a part of their expression of love as an individual. So I think that it's biblical for us to demand, as I talked about St. Olaf, that those who are found guilty in this whole Watergate affair, whether it was those who are involved in the break-in who are convicted, or those who will have been proved to have perjured themselves, or those who are involved in the illegal cover-up, then to go through our whole system of justice, and as the facts are proven, to receive their punishment for it. To give you an example then of General Turner that I spoke of last night, because I knew General Turner, he came to me to see if a member of Congress could intervene to help him. And I really, at first, was taken aback on this, because I'd learned to love that guy, and I am more conscious of that with people that are difficult to love, because, you know, he wasn't a Marine, but he if you think of the military, he's more typical Marine, you know, and he was shorter in stature than the average person, and so he had the bandy rooster about him, and, you know, the butch haircut, you know, he was just tough as can be, and as they say, you might think he knew the Lord because he used his name so much. But I turned him down, that I would not. That's something that has to go through our system of justice. And to the extent that you're proven wrong, you have to face up to that and talk to them that I still love them and stay with him even when he was in jail. And I think that's the way the system of justice. I think it would not have been
an act of love to have stepped in, if it was possible, and intervened through the Justice Department and asked them to withdraw charges against them, or the Treasury Department in this case. I don't think it would be possible, but you know instances of individuals who become powerful enough in their committee that they do affect the actions of at least the executive branch, and therefore the executive branch would bring charges to go through the judicial system. I don't think it would have been an act of love any more than it's an act of love not to reprimand your child when the time is right to do it. So to me, that they talk about the system of Judeo-Christian belief coming through our system. I think that's how the justice is expressed in that way. Now, a person who is a judge, then, who is in a position individually to do something, he can't express his love by showing mercy in the way that justice is meted out to a person who's found guilty.
Your philosophy of love includes what its components, you know, it's fine with economic problems or education, but I don't think I can hold such philosophy with Vietnam to the recent memory. I mean, surely you wouldn't consider your, I mean, you feel hypocritical saying a prayer meeting of Adolf Hitler, you know, and feeling a fellowship of Christian love between the two of you. And there's a lot of it that you, Richard Nixon and his war supporters in the same way as Adolf Hitler, you know, they found it extreme. And I just can't, you know, the whole philosophy is being wishy-washy. I mean, I can't, couldn't imagine sitting down praying with some guy that was going to go out and bomb Cambodia and civilians, you know.
I can only talk about what I've had experience with, and so I've never had this opportunity. And this has been a struggle for me all the way along. So I wish I could give you an answer that I had figured out. But I can't on that, because you know, what can you do out of love? And I come to ask myself the question, could I kill a person out of love? And that I don't have the answer for. I know that if somebody, you know, you read the book To Kill a Mockingbird and the whole question of the mad dog, that if somebody was about to kill somebody in my family, I believe that I would kill him to prevent him from doing that. Now, I can't tell you whether that's an act of Christian love or not. I can't tell if that's something that's just the animal instinct within me, but I tell you what I think would be my reaction if it occurred. Now, from that, then you come to the question of Vietnam, and I think there may have been a time in the beginning of the war when some people believed that by killing North Vietnamese they were saving South Vietnamese, that is, stepping in and preventing somebody from being killed by killing another person. But I think the whole thing moved away from that, so we got ourselves in the horrible situation of not knowing how to extricate ourselves from the whole mess we got in. I think that you might feel, and a number of people feel, that this country should have admitted its wrongdoing. As an individual would, I think, if he lived his life in love. But it seems very difficult for a country to do that, because a country is not an individual that way too. Just like in World War II, we demanded unconditional surrender, and that poor felt we got the penitence from the other side who we thought were guilty. And I think that the people who feel strongly that our country was immoral in what they did in Vietnam would like to have seen some sign of that unconditional surrender or repentance on the part of our government. And that's why this whole thing is so dissatisfying, that you kind of peter out to the end and nothing has been decided. But I couldn't sit down and pray with Adolf Hitler. I don't find people who do not love Christ able to sit down and pray with me. You know, they don't want to do that. But the question is, take a person who was active in church and Sunday school, Billy Saul Estes. That's something that I haven't been able to resolve in my own mind. What if you had been praying with that person or working with him in the church and he ended up guilty of that wrongdoing? I imagine that there was something faulty in his moral standards and his real understanding of Christ, and that you'd try and bring him to a better understanding, and perhaps that experience in his life, which looked like a horrible thing at the time for him, may have then caused him to have a renewal in his life. May not, too. Couldn't have made it worse. But it may appear wishy-washy, but I'm convinced it works with the ones who I relate with.
Well, the fact that a person calls himself a Christian doesn't really mean he is. I mean, his whole life is the antithesis of Christianity. It's just not a phrase that goes to a breath to be, where they pray. It doesn't mean he's a Christian.
No.
At all, and that's where
but he may have a better opportunity through that to learn to know Christ. Yeah.
I think part of the problem is we always have this human tendency to put sin in terms of degree. For example, one thing is worse than another thing. And there was a day in the church when smoking or drinking was, couldn't be a Christian and smoke or drink. Well, in our day, we start thinking about political involvement and Vietnam. Can a person be a Christian and still do what some others consider to be very, very wrong? And when we start setting up degrees of wrongness, I think we run into this problem of who are we going to pray with and who aren't we?
Yeah.
We have to meet people in the love of Christ, which is one way to meet, which is our commitment. But we are also said to love our enemies and love those who don't share.
Mm-hmm.
This is not just your enemy and taking not to be part of the criticism, the real enemy that we are actually finding for work, that we don't agree with them enough, that we will go out and do things that we do not believe in the Christian side.
Mm-hmm.
Do we really love our enemy enough to think that we can base our talk and kind of call things in a different way? This is the objection to one, I think. Do we really believe sincerely enough to have the truth to try to push the other means of solution? Or do we always go back and rejudge that? Where do we end? Where do we turn on the tape and this is serving the truth?
I think our country acted where the people expressed their love through justice after World War II and helping Germany and Japan. And it bothers me now that we're sort of building up the anti-help for North Vietnam attitude in this nation. And it isn't just those who were in support of the war in Vietnam. It's just probably stronger or as strong from those who oppose the war in Vietnam all the time.
I'm wondering, out of the situation of Vietnam, if we aren't coming closer to what you were saying, that we don't need a war. We found out that we can negotiate and find peaceful ways to living with one another, and the adverse situation that we were in. All the terribleness of Vietnam has forced us to think of other ways of dealing with one another rather than killing, and that doesn't justify the war, but I think that it pushed us against the wall to this is the last, and we can't go that way anymore, and it's been so bad. Pardon?
They said that after World War II, if we're not war again, it will be the end. We have learned. They said that after World War I.
Well, maybe it's another hope and another faith.
And also
we hook these two points together. The first part of your morning involved love, and then I started asking questions about secrecy and open freedom. And your last one, the last sentence that you made was, we found ourselves in a situation in Vietnam where we could not extricate ourselves. I submit that we did not find ourselves in a situation, but that the government did, because the average person just didn't know. We didn't have enough information to make the issue to know whether we should extricate or not extricate. And that had we had at one time a greater amount of freedom, of access, respecting executive committees for functioning of bodies, that we would not have gotten to the point that extrication would have even been a question. And it had to be really hooked on to the Christian statement of openness and freedom at first, and that the second situation simply would not have existed for our government. Now, that might have left questions about what's going to happen to Vietnam, but that might be a little different question than the one we found ourselves involved with.
No, I was talking about the government that didn't know how to extricate itself from Vietnam. You're right, as far as Vietnam is concerned, as we find out now, the bombing in Cambodia, so much of it has been kept from us. But and this isn't a war that was covered by the press more than any other war has ever been. I don't know how many ships in World War II were sunk by kamikaze pilots before any information that a kamikaze pilot existed came to our nation. And so in World War II, we didn't know anywhere as much as we did about this war. But even so, I think our problem here as a nation is not knowing a different culture and a different people. And we want to make everybody like ourselves. I think this is what happened in the United Nations. We thought everybody would think alike if we got to debating in the United Nations. And it hasn't worked that way. We've all been different. When we went into Vietnam, we only had one person, I understand, who even spoke the language, and that was an Englishman who was working with nobody else did. And so you can imagine trying to work through interpreters dealing with the people to even do that wisely. I think the reason why Douglas MacArthur was as successful as he was in Japan is that he understood the Oriental mind. And at times, you have an individual who comes to the fore like that. We didn't have anybody like that at all in Vietnam. We had area centers in the nation which built up because of the National Defense Education Act. And which now, to my dismay, they're trying to defund. But at least we had some centers of developing expertise on Southeast Asia. But I don't think they were used at all in developing our policy at all. Because I never found anybody who had studied in one of the Southeast Asia centers who was involved in either the State Department or the Defense Department. And anybody I talked from those centers knew no one who had gone into it at all. So I think this is a problem that we've had as a nation. But also on Vietnam, our whole national attitude was developed in World War II, and that is that if we had moved in to the war when Hitler went into the lowlands, we would have stopped World War II. I mean, that was pretty much the feeling. And that carried through, and it was the attitude when Truman moved in and Greece and Turkey, when the communists were moving, it seemed like a success there. It was the attitude that pushed us into involvement in the Korean War, and the Russians just happened to be out of the Security Council at that time, so they couldn't veto us, and therefore we got into that involvement, didn't learn anything from it. And I think we were again stopping a Hitler in lowland in Vietnam when we got into that. And that's why the American people just followed along in that whole policy till now. They realized the mistake, and as a result of that, I think we probably will see the cycle of the American attitude between World War I and World War II now expressing itself. Now, whether that will end up with Fortress America or not, it's hard to tell at the present time. But the new Nixon doctrine that was espoused in Guam in 1969 is one to keep withdrawing our military forces all over the world and eventually retreat back to our own why here. Even, I mean, you got to look at the rhetoric what this man is saying and what the policy is behind which was expressed in Guam, and that is to retreat back again. Mary? and he didn't know a word of Japanese. You know, he had completely divorced himself from his ancestry, and he didn't know any more about the culture of the Japanese or the language of the Japanese than his American counterparts. So that wasn't any help that we have Japanese living here in the country. And so I think that's one of the mistakes we have. A colleague of mine, John Bradamus, and I got together and passed an International Education Act, and we've never been able to secure funding for that. Now, 6-8 years ago, I think, we got the legislation passed. About 6 years ago, we still haven't got $1 for that program.
Why is more important than when people go overseas, they're setting a great example. They're adapting their country. And
just gone through hell for a number of years. And I don't want to use his name because you read about this guy in the newspaper. Now, if you ask an awful lot of my colleagues, they would certainly think he was probably next to the devil, because he's really giving President Nixon a hard time. But I've gotten to know him well, and he's in the last half year has really come to an understanding of his Lord and given himself to it. And it bothers him terribly, and because he's giving Nixon for the rough time, and what people think of, about that. Yet I'm convinced he's doing it out of love as best he can. To give you an example about the guy, his daughter was found to have cancer, very serious, and has now had an operation. And he is the most joyous person. And that can only come because he understands that all things work together for good to them that love God. And he just comes to an understanding of that. And so that's why I say you can get to know a person once in a while that way. And but you don't know how many are like that.